This show contains discussions of violence, murder, abuse, suicide, some use of language, and other things that some people may find offensive. We don't recommend Crime Cafe for children under the age of 14. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome or welcome back to this very special episode of Crime Cafe Podcast. I'm Coral. In today's episode, we had the opportunity to speak with Beth Rowland, the author of Gone in the Fog blog, a blog dedicated to telling the story of Cheryl Spiegel, a 10-year-old girl from Highland Heights, Kentucky, who was brutally murdered on her 10th birthday in 1971. Beth is answering some of mine and Amber's burning questions, and let me tell you, you are in for a treat, because what Beth told us has Amber and I both on the edge of our seats. What you may have learned from last week's episode on Cheryl just scratches the surface of this case. Today you will learn that not everything is what it seems, the truth may be closer to home, and how the love of a little girl's story can impact so many lives. Without further ado, Beth Rowland.
So I grew up here in Northern Kentucky. I still live here. And my husband is a police officer, and his dad was a police officer, and we started dating when we were teenagers, and he, a time or two, had told me about this man that lived on a porch in a house in Highland Heights, which is a town, like one town over from where I lived, and I had passed by that house with that man on the porch, like, hundreds of times in my life, and I asked him, who is it, and my husband, because he's a guy and doesn't know, because I ask 1,000 questions and he doesn't. But he said, my dad just always told us to stay away from that man in his truck if he ever approached us. And of course, I said, why? And he said something about he killed a kid or he killed a girl or whatever. And I was like, and you don't know who, you know, he had no idea who it was, when it happened or whatever. And that was in like 96, 97, something, when I was finishing high school, starting college. And I always liked the show Unsolved Mysteries and Dateline and all those kind of mystery shows. But it was like something that stuck in my head, but I wasn't ready yet. I didn't really know I was going to deep dive and try and solve the mystery, but it always intrigued me. And then it was maybe like 3 or 4 years ago when I started listening to true crime podcasts and really getting into it more. I kept thinking, well, we have this local unsolved murder. Somebody needs to look at it. And I realized when I kind of started searching that you couldn't even find anything about there being an unsolved murder up here. And then that just led to more questions, to more questions. And over time, it was like I asked the first person who recommended I talk to somebody else, who recommended I talk to somebody else. And then it led me to talking to the former cops, and that it's now snowballed into like this whole project that even, you know, a lot of people up here are invested in trying to solve this mystery. But until I really started asking questions, it was, you know, kind of, most people did not talk about it or did not know about it. And so that's what I do in my free time. And then I work, I'm a teacher, and I have 3 kids, and my husband's a police officer. So we're just busy. But it's like, on all my free time, I'm researching, I'm sending messages, I'm making phone calls, I'm writing for the blog. And the blog started because friends of mine and acquaintances and people that knew I was looking into this would ask me what the latest is. Like, have you talked to the police, and have you solved it yet, and what have you found? And so I just needed a place to put the information that I could share with everybody. And I found that writing it, I knew that I could write it and tell it authentically, was better than me trying to do a podcast, just because I didn't know enough about it. And I think I do better when I can write, rewrite, like really mean what I say, and then just trying to talk it out and stumble over my words. So it just worked better for me to put it in a blog form.
We asked Beth if she ever considered starting a true crime podcast of her own about Cheryl, along with other unsolved murders.
I am so invested in this one case and solving it that I don't know how to do it like in an hour episode and then move on. Like, I can't let it go. I think I'm OCD that way. So it's like I do have ideas if I were to do this again for other local cases, but I can't even start that because I'm so emotionally involved with this one. And I don't know if that's healthy or not, but it's kind of like I knew once I started that I was going to have to see it through. Like, you can't kind of be halfway in. I don't know if that makes sense. It's like I was all in to see it to the end. And I don't know when the end will be. I mean, I would love it if that is when we solve it. But I at least want to be able to walk away and say, I have turned over every rock. I have taken every tree. And there is nobody left to talk to. And this is what it is. We may never know. But I have nobody can come behind me and say, I can do more. I don't know if that sounds like vain, but it's like, I want people to say that I did the best that I could possibly do. I feel that you're bringing a voice to those cases, to those missing people, to those murdered people, which is awesome. That's why I think the genre is catching on with people, and it's helping to solve some of these, which is great. I just don't know. I don't know how to do it that way, I guess. So actually, in the very beginning, I thought about doing a podcast. And when I was writing, it was kind of like, this is what I would say if I were writing the narrative of the podcast. Mm-hmm. But then I realized I wanted to have interviews with people, and most people didn't want to be recorded. I did ask in the beginning. I said, like, just for my own notes, would it be okay? And a lot of people weren't real big on it because they were going to be talking kind of badly about, like, a former neighbor or a family member. So then I thought, okay, well, forget it. I don't need to record it. Ultimately I want to solve it. It is what it is for me. And if it doesn't end up being a podcast, then I'll write a book. I don't know. I don't even, to be honest, care about the product as much as just the result. Every little tidbit of, you know, I saw a cardinal or somebody shared this dream with me or whatever. It's authentic. It's exactly. So there's not, I wanted people to feel like you are totally in it with me. If you've read the entire blog, you pretty much are where I am with this. It got to the point where I caught up to real time. Now, like just today, some other things started happening and it's like, ooh, but that'll be coming. I'll be writing about it. It's just, I have to research it and chase it down before I share it, of course. Because every once in a while something comes up and then it's not worthwhile. So it's like, I'm not going to waste people's time. When it really isn't anything.
Beth talked with us about her best friend, Bridget, who is, if you've read or listened to the blog, is Beth's partner in the investigation of Cheryl's case.
She's a lot more funny than I am, I think. She just is. But it's fine. We all study each other. Where I'm more like, you know, she wants to go to where they found Cheryl's body and start digging right now. And I'm like, I think we need to, like, get permission. Like, she was my first friend who, like, we become way better friends in the past 3 years doing this, but at the time she was like, I'll help you, what do you need me to do? I can give her the name of somebody, or I can give her like an email address and she can find the person in 20 minutes. So like, I'm kind of good at it, but she, no, like, she can. And it's weird how it's like the one person that volunteered is strong in the areas where I'm not always. So I read the autopsy report. Like, I'm the paperwork person. I'm the email person. I go, and like, I had to go and get the report, and I came home and I was reading it. It's like, I talked to my husband about it a little bit, and then I like called Bridget. So that's not something that you sit around and chit chat with people, but you have to get your person, because, you know, you got to be able to talk about it, because it'll mess with your head if you don't. She is a blessing.
Amber asked Beth how far Cheryl lived from the bus stop.
It's in walking distance. So if you imagine like a cul-de-sac street without sidewalks, so it's narrow and there's like, I think there's parking on both sides and there's not big side yards. So just, you know, house, 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 house. I think there's, let's say, 100 houses, maybe like 50 on each side. She was probably 2/3 of the way down on the right, and the bus literally came at the top of the street. So all the kids from that little cul-de-sac street would walk to the top and stand right at the top of their own street. So we actually were going to have my 12-year-old daughter one day start in Cheryl's front yard and walk just at a normal pace. And I bet you it takes 6 minutes. 5 sounds not enough, but I bet you it's not 10. And then I was going to have her do it again and say, hurry, like move with purpose. If it would cut it in half. You can't, the way that the street is though, and when you get right to the top, so when you're leaving the street, when you're headed out of the street, it kind of takes like a hook to the left. So if I'm a parent and I step out of the front door of my house and look to the top of the street, you cannot see the entrance, which is not good. There is a street light there now, but everyone that grew up on that street have all agreed that there was not a light back then. Let me explain this too. The way that our school district is here, they were doing two-a-days at the time because they had such high attendance. So it sounds totally baffling to people that kids were waiting for the bus at 6:30, but they were sending kids from like 7 to like 1:30, and then a second group of kids were going from like late afternoon to evening. So her group, like the people there in the street, were all the early morning kids, and they were little ones all the way up to high schoolers, all rode the same bus. So she stood up there, she stood up there with kids of all ages, but right. They would take her and her age group, which was first grade to fifth grade, to the local elementary school, which was in walking distance. It would have taken probably 20 minutes to walk there, but occasionally, apparently, some of the kids walked. And then the middle school was, I think, housed at the same place as the high school, and it was a lot farther out. So those kids got dropped off way later, including her own brothers, because they were older than her, but they all rode the same bus, but they continued on out to the county school, if that makes sense. To update you all, because I haven't really done this in the blog yet, but there was a family that said they saw her at their house that morning. I know you talked about this because it was in the blog, and that she left. But now I've gone back and talked to those people, and I've talked to the detective, and they have all agreed that that incident happened, but it was not that morning. As of now, besides her brothers and her dad, no one else can verify that they laid eyes on her that morning. So after they left the house, if she left the house, if somebody took her off the street, nobody on the street saw it happen, which is interesting because there were a lot of kids that rode that bus, and there were a lot of parents out kind of escorting their kids or standing on their own porches, and nobody said they saw her pass by. Nobody said they saw her in a car. But if she was delayed, then maybe that's why everybody else had kind of gone back in. The kids were getting on the bus, and then she comes later. The timeline is very important for that piece of the story.
We asked Beth about when Cheryl's brothers realized they didn't know where Cheryl was.
They did not tell the bus driver. So they must have been on the bus that started at the county high school, junior high. They pull into the elementary school to pick up the little kids, and Cheryl does not get on the bus. Now, this is literally a stone's throw from their house. So once she didn't get on the bus, I guess the two of them were like, what the heck? You know, like, where is she? And when they were let off at the top of the street, when they walked home, their stepmother was there, and they told her. And the brother told us, Bridget and I, that they convinced their stepmom to call the school to ask, and when she called the school, they said, well, Cheryl was absent today, and they didn't know that. So they waited for their dad to get home from work, got home from work, everyone in the family agreed, okay, you don't know where she is, you don't know where she is, you know. They called the police. The police came out and did a little initial report. It was her birthday, so then it was like, well, maybe she's somewhere with a friend, or maybe she's doing this, whatever, which the whole thing aggravates me because I have a 10-year-old, and like, we all know that that's not how life happens. Like, you don't just go off for an entire day, but whatever. And so they said, if she's not back tomorrow by dinner time, call us back. So they got up the next day. Dad went to work. The boys went to school. They have no idea where Cheryl is. Keep that in mind. And she's not there by dinner time the next night. And then they called the police back. And that's when they brought in like 100 volunteers and the search party, and they started going door to door, and nobody knew where she was. Yeah, that had been over. That was, what, 36 hours later? Because that would have been, like, late in the afternoon of the 20th of October when she disappeared on the morning of the 19th. And even in her circle, like, there was a couple girls that lived on the street, and they are probably her, quote-unquote, like, closest friends. But even they were like, I don't know where she is. So, like, her circle was not very big, right? Where is a 10-year-old going to go? We can talk about family a little bit, but they didn't have this big extended family. Mm-hmm. You know, if one of my kids disappeared, I have a lot of brothers and sisters, so does my husband. So chances are one of the aunts or uncles maybe, you know, It's more likely because we have a bigger circle that he jumped in the van with my sister-in-law, whatever. Whereas this was not like that back then. They had a very small family. So, and they didn't live local either, but that's a whole other story.
In this next part, Beth is referring to the detective currently on Cheryl's case as he.
I asked him that. I said, because he oversees the police file that I don't have, but if I ask him questions, he'll usually research it for me. So I said, like, can you tell me if in that file in your interviews with neighbors, and because they apparently did interview everybody after they found her body. They gave a lot of polygraphs and they talked to the neighborhood. And he said that as far as he could tell, no one had seen her that day. There was one other lady on the street that says she thought she saw her that morning walking back from the bus stop back down the street. But it was 2 weeks after they found Cheryl's body, which it was like 2 weeks after she disappeared. So the police had said, well, they can't. The woman was not sure, nor could the police confirm that did happen. That sighting was like on that day.
One of mine and Amber's most burning questions was regarding the milkman.
They did interview him like multiple times and they gave him a polygraph. And his story stayed the same, and he passed the polygraph. And his whereabouts were kind of verified in terms of an alibi. Like, he did all of his deliveries on all the days he was supposed to. He returned his milk truck on time. I think they spoke with the wife. Like, no, I mean, and granted, we know that spouses cover, but there was no, like, glaring unaccounted for time, you know, where he was off doing something. So I would say that he was never officially eliminated, but they just couldn't connect him to it. And I will say in his defense, there are people I really respect who have researched his case and stuff, who still have him as a prime suspect. So I'm not willing to write him off completely. He's not real high on my list, but I will say that he chose that spot regularly to go to the bathroom. And I know that that's whatever, but it's a country delivery. There's not bathrooms like there are today. And this little lane where this overpass was has a pull off where you can park your car. It's still there. And it's like just a gravel. It's not like a parking lot. It's like literally like the road just kind of goes over and there's gravel. So he would park his truck there and then go to the bathroom. And he did admit, and this is kind of gross, that sometimes he even had to go number two. He did not that day, but that was like his spot. So he stood there, and when you look over the side, I've not seen the crime scene photos, but the detective described it to me. Because when I heard she was under rocks, I'm thinking, and this is where Bridget makes fun of me, like just like a little pyramid of rocks, like it was a mound of rocks. It looks like one of those burials that you see like in Europe above ground with grass. Like it's literally like over a body. It was like a complete hump of huge rocks in the middle of the creek. Pulled them right there from the creek. There were rocks everywhere. And like huge landscaping rocks, if you can imagine that. Like, you know what I mean? Like big, heavy rocks. When he saw that huge mound in the middle of the creek, it did not look right. Like, that doesn't form that way. So he saw it the week before and thought, that's weird, but then just got in his truck and went. Everything, you can look at it in a different lens. But supposedly, like, I mean, he was a preacher. He had his own church, you know, and of course some people say, of course. So it was Dennis Rader, and, you know, so like, right, like, whatever. So I don't say it, but, like, they said that it ruined his life. Like, he said he wished he would, because someone was going to be the person to find her, right? And, like, sadly, it could have been me. It could have been, you know what I mean? Like, it could have been a mom driving over the station wagon and looked over and saw a hand. It could have been somebody inevitably was going to see it, because it was in the middle of a creek on a lane that people did drive by. But you kind of had to go down and look over the embankment to have seen it. You know, if you were just driving, you probably wouldn't have noticed, because the rocks match the landscaping. Now, they did interview a lot of it. Well, I shouldn't say a lot, because there's not really a residence on this old lane. There's like a couple houses at the very top, and then this is all just kind of desolate. And some of them you know, said, well, I saw like a white car pass through there one day, and they were chasing down just random cars that, but people did travel the road. So, but not that I know of that anybody else reports seeing the rocks. And I have talked to people who knew him, that was their mailman, and they have nothing but like wonderful stories about how kind he was. And that, like, the one man was like, my mom even said, you can, before this even happened, always offered to let him use their bathroom. Like, hey, if you're ever out, and he was like, oh, no, ma'am. Like, he would never go into people's homes. Like, so I'm not, again, you could, I mean, Ted Bundy was charming. Like, so I'm not saying that that is excusing it away, but there is no reports of him being a child molester or a rapist. In some of these crimes, you would see that pattern. Doesn't mean there's not an anomaly, but it's in fairness, there's just not enough connection besides the fact that he found her body. When he picked up the milk in the morning, he did pass by Rose Avenue a couple days a week, but mm-hmm. not on Tuesdays. And she disappeared on a Tuesday, and he should have not been in the area on Tuesday. That was not his route. And there's no report that he missed any of his stops on Tuesday. So, again, that makes him not there the day that she went missing. And then what's the story, right? The milkman drives by, sees her somehow in the dark and the fog. There's a girl by herself. Hey, little girl, do you want to get on my milk truck? And then gets her on the truck. And then what, continues to deliver milk all day with a kid in the back? Or, like, after he found the body and he saw the hand, they said, like, do you know who it is? And, like, he was like, well, the only missing person I've heard about is that kid from, you know, like, Northern Kentucky. And they were like, oh, how did you know about her? Well, it had been in the paper and stuff. Mm-hmm. So some people thought it was interesting that he thought that it might be her. But if you did read the news, you would know she was missing. You know, some people said it could have been an ice pick, you know, that killed her. It was a tiny, tiny weapon. Like, he would have had, you know, he could have kept her in that truck. He could have killed her in the morning and kept her on the truck all day while he delivered milk, which is disgusting, and then deposited her at the end of his stop down there on that road because he knew it was a isolated place. And then, like you all kind of indicated, which other people have too, after 2 weeks, then like, oh, man, nobody's finding her. So then yeah. He alerts the authorities. So in that narrative, it makes sense. But a lot of people are like, why was he down there? How would he have seen the rocks? Well, there is a reason why he was down there and why he saw the rocks. So I just want to, like, give some clarification to that. Again, doesn't mean he's innocent, but in 3 years, Bridget and I both, like, I was convinced it was somebody in the family. And then I started learning more about the man on the porch, and I'm like, holy cow, all this time, all these stories were coming in. And then I found out about the drug dealer on the street and some mm-hmm. of the shady stuff and some of the statements he made. And I'm like, oh my God, it's him. And now I literally, I can wake up every day and I convinced, I mean, I'll walk away from this conversation and be like, it probably was the milkman. The only way it could be somebody completely random that we would never have known is if she decided to walk to school and was out on the mm-hmm. highway and somebody picked her up.
One of the most glaring facts about Cheryl's case is that she was murdered on her 10th birthday and found on her brother's 11th birthday.
I do. Her brothers do not. But I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I don't know. But I just can't believe that of 365 days a year, that was the day. I do think it fits somehow. And there's certain kind of stories, like with this John guy who has told people he killed her, and the birthday fits into the story. But I'm not convinced of his story. But, like, I think either it goes to the scenario of what happened. Her brothers will say that it was, of all the days, she just had really bad luck, and it happened on her birthday. But I think, I do. I think it plays in somehow. But it depends on what narrative I'm going to follow as to how it plays in, if that makes sense. I almost threw up when I saw when his birthday was. I made a Spiegel family tree because I just needed to see it as I was finding everybody and their date and how they're all connected. So I just started uploading it. So when I researched Mark and I saw his birthday and I was like entering it, I was like, oh my God, that's the same day. Like, and then I found that newspaper interview where he said it ruined his life. And I'm like, well, yeah, it did. Because I don't believe he killed her. I don't think a 10, 11 year old boy killed her. And again, I could be wrong, but like, I do think it ruined his life. And I think it's just a cruel, whether her birthday is significant, I don't think her being found on his birthday is significant. It's just a cruel irony. But the weird thing is she disappeared. So for every year that they were alive together, from October 19th to November 2nd, they were both the same age. And then he would have his birthday and become a year older. And exactly from October 19th to his birthday is when she was missing. Like, what are the odds of that? After all this time and everything I found out, I would say she knew who it was. I mean, the only scenario that she didn't know who it was is if she was randomly plucked off the street by a passerby. But I just think the odds of that are so astronomical. Like, it's not that it's unheard of, but in that 6:30 on a Tuesday morning, in the complete dark and fog, the right child murderer is driving by, the odds are very slim. So therefore, that leads me to believe, especially when I look at the other suspects, they all were acquaintances or connected to her. So yes, I think she knew who they were. If I had to reenact it in my head, I think it was in a fit of anger. I imagined her being like slashed with a knife 23 times, but once I read the autopsy report and saw that the wounds were 0.4 centimeters, which is 0.125 of an inch, that means that to me, if I pick up a knife and I go after someone, I am going to stab you to death. I think it's more like somebody got really mad, whether it was a fight, like an argument, or she resisted somebody's advances or something, and they picked up the nearest thing, whether it was an ice pick, a car punch, like something on hand. And I haven't seen her autopsy photos. Even if I was allowed to see them, I don't think I could do it. But it was described to me that her wounds were like in clusters. So there was like three patches that almost look like pimples of about eight wounds. So it's almost like somebody picked something up and went like, boom, 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 like punch, 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 and then stopped and went like, boom, 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 boom. Like, does that make sense? You're so mad at them, like hitting. But it punctured her heart and punctured her liver, and she just like had internal bleeding and died. But it probably happened really fast. And I would say maybe that person would have been like, holy shit, what did I just do? Like, once your senses come back, that's what I think. I don't necessarily think it was just planned murder, that a weapon was brought and it was like, today is the day she's going to die. Like, I could be wrong. I just don't see it that way. I think somebody reacted and used whatever they had. No signs of strangulation, no obvious bruising. Like, I mean, you know, the state of her body wasn't great, but, like, no obvious bruising, let's say. So it did not look like she had been in a big fight or, you know, had been strangled or anything. It was literally those wounds. The papers all said she was stabbed and raped. And the police really went with the whole rape angle and said this is, like, a psychotic sexual predator kind of person back then in the 70s. But I have learned from reading the reports and stuff that the medical examiner did not confirm that she had been raped. Because of the decomposition, they could not say. And they did vaginal swabs to test for sperm, and it came back negative for sperm on the swabs. And I know perfectly well it could be because it's 2 weeks. You know, that evidence could have all washed away in the creek or whatever. But they said, doesn't mean sperm was not present. It just wasn't present at autopsy. So therefore, they did not officially say that she had been raped. So there is a discrepancy between what the police think happened and what the medical examiner confirmed. And that is a big deal to me, because if you stab someone without raping, it's not necessarily sexually driven crime. But if you're raping someone and killing them afterwards, or killing them and raping, whatever, it's more of a sexually motivated crime. So then that sends, if you go down the path and say, okay, she wasn't raped in the traditional sense, so to speak, like, that opens up the door for why it even happened. Could have been in a fit of rage and had nothing to do with a sexual element. And the thing is like, this is like, as a female and as a mother, it's like, I hope that she wasn't raped, because that makes the terror even worse. But then I'm like pissed that there wasn't sperm. They would have had it, and they probably would have kept it, and we'd probably know a lot more. And okay, so I guess I can say it. She was stabbed one time in the genital area. You know, I mean, that still does make it a sexual nature crime, but that has to do with the rage, I guess, whether it's performance issue or resisting your advances issue or whatever. I think overall, too, there were a lot of kids that lived on that street. There were a lot of little girls that lived on that street that were a little younger than Cheryl, Cheryl's age, and a little older. Is it random that she was targeted, or is it, it was just destined to be her? And I mean, like, you know how some kids are just more likely to be victimized over somebody else? It's like, yeah, if people were randomly picking a girl up off the street that day, I guess obviously it has to be somebody, but like, why was it her and not any of the other people that lived on that street? That's where I'm thinking, like, she was targeted.
Beth goes on to tell us what happened the morning of October 19th, according to Billy Joe, Cheryl's dad.
Literally, here's the story. She was awake early, like she usually was, got herself dressed for school. She's 10 years old. It's her birthday. So most girls at that age are excited because it's their birthday, let's say. It's still early in the morning. the brothers say that the dad never let her leave the house without them and that the neighbors are mistaken. I don't think they're necessarily lying. I just think that they might not remember, whatever. But let's say it was a day where she wasn't out of the house without them. So she's waiting. Somehow she falls back to sleep, they say. The boys get up. They're getting ready for school. The dad looks in. Cheryl's back asleep. He turns to the brothers and says, you guys have to go because you can't miss the bus. Because in his defense, if they missed the bus, he'd have to drive them all the way out to the high school. And that's a far drive compared to the elementary school, which is essentially across the street. But they say, okay, and they hurry out the door at 6:20. Dad says he sees her leave at 6:25 by herself, out the door in the dark and the fog. So my question becomes, what did she have to do to get ready that they couldn't have waited 2 minutes? If she was never allowed to leave the house without him, what was she doing? Like, putting on her shoes? I don't think she was brushing her teeth. They said they didn't talk to her that day, so she wasn't having a conversation with anybody. So, like, if they weren't allowed to leave the house without their sister in the morning, why did the dad say, go, 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 and they didn't wait? And then she goes at 6:25. They left 5 minutes prior, apparently, and she didn't catch up. Like, they're still walking up the street with everybody else. I recently found out that the bus didn't come until 6:50. No way that it takes her 20 minutes to get to the top of the street that she missed that bus. So something doesn't ring true to me. Or all of that's true, and she went out that back door, which they said they always use the back door because they didn't want to mess up the carpet by the front door. I don't think that that's odd. I think that that's like a Kentucky grandma thing. My grandparents, we never used the front door, like, it's because that's the nice entrance for company. Then if you believe their whole story, then she went out that back door, and somewhere pretty damn close, somebody picked her up
and knew that she was late.
Yeah. Again, so, like, let's say you go back to the milkman. How did he know she was going to be out there by herself? He didn't. Or the family is being honest, and she held back. She was hanging back for a reason, because she was going to get picked up, or somebody had promised her they were taking her somewhere for her birthday, or whatever. The problem is, I don't know who that person would have been. The back of that whole side of the street is woods. And if you would stick to those woods, like, let's say you just took off running straight into the woods out her back door, you're going to eventually go down a hillside and it's going to lead to the Ohio River. But it's perilous. It's not like a little trail. Like, I wouldn't say that anybody at a 10-year-old at 6:30 in the morning is going to go into the deep, dark woods by themselves. But could somebody have been in the woods laying in wait or something? Yes. But again, before cell phones and her using a house phone and everything, how would they have known to grab her?
Yeah.
And who was she communicating with? Like, hey, I'll hang behind. And I don't think she was that, I don't want to say devious, but like that calculated enough to have planned something with an adult. Now, could all of that be true? The brothers are telling the truth. All of that is true, but she didn't leave at 6:25 because either dad kept her there, they had a fight, or he set her up for someone to come pick her up. Absolutely. Yeah, like, she was never on the street that day. She was held back for a reason. And the brothers are being honest, and they said they saw her, and her dad said she's got to get ready, and they went on with their day. And whatever happened after 6:25. I think Bridget is in agreement with me, like, kind of seeing how I see it. She does not like John, the guy that owned the business nearby. And we can talk about him a little bit, but I think she's more focused on John. Kind of like how you guys hone in on the milkman, like, John, is kind of her guy. I don't like him. There's things about him that really give me pause. So I don't mean to come across like I'm blaming on the family. I don't know, because we met her brothers, and they were great to us, and they were nice, and they seemed very genuine. And the brother that's only like a year older is still like riddled with grief. Like, he could barely speak. He, like, it has rotted him from the inside out. Like, I can't explain it. I've never been in the presence of a person that, I mean, and I don't mean it like because he's a bad guy. It's like it has killed his soul. It was horrible to see. And their dad never spoke of her again. The way I say it is, somebody buried her once. Why bury her again? Yeah. I will give them the family credit, I think, on the obituary, in that I think back then you had to pay by the word for obituaries, and they didn't have money. So it was brief, probably because they couldn't have afforded more. And I it was just in the way that I wrote. You know, when I read an obituary, you can learn so much from it. Like, I've done a lot of research. Obituaries will get you the family tree. And it's just interesting that if you're paying by the word, it's brief, but then they did use two adjectives, right? Like, what was it? Dear and beloved, which I'm like, well, that's nice. And they paid for those words, you know, like, it just doesn't capture who she was, right? If a kid today was murdered, think of the picture they would have put in the story that would have been wrapped around it, the outcry, and there was none of it. If I steer the ship away from him and say, okay, he wasn't involved, just the guilt that you couldn't have protected your child. You know, I would hate myself for the rest of my life if I let my daughter walk out of my house by herself like that and something bad happened. I would never forgive myself. Like, is it any parent that, you know, when something happens, you probably, you know, I should have done this, I wish I would have been there, or if I had done this. So, like, I could see how he just feels the guilt that his daughter was killed, you know, and that he couldn't protect her if he's innocent of it. And I do think that men back then, you didn't talk about emotions. So there's a part of me that'll give him a pass for not really talking about it, because you just didn't. You put your best foot forward and you moved on, and you just didn't talk about grief and loss. And so all of those little things, you know, you could say, well, it was a short obituary and she didn't get a headstone because they didn't have money. He didn't talk about her much because that's how men deal with grief. They moved away 2 months after she was killed. They moved out of the house, they packed up their shit, and they moved. Maybe it's because he suspected everybody that lived on the street as being the killer, and he didn't want his boys in the neighborhood, you know? Or maybe he didn't want the police talking to him anymore. Like, you got the hell out of it. Like, you literally could look at it either way.
Beth told us a little bit about John, who was allegedly the best suspect and the prime suspect in Cheryl's case.
He is what some of the cops look for, in that he was a child molester. He was like in with the car thieves. He was not a good guy. I haven't met anybody that knew him. I've spoken to no one who knew him that has anything good to say about him. He was scary. He was mean. He was shady. He was everything. And he apparently was molesting like girls in his own family. And finally, one of them turned him in like 1977-ish. This is like, you know, a handful of years after Cheryl was killed. And once he was arrested for that crime, one of the victims came forward and said, he has told me on numerous occasions that he killed Cheryl. And he explained to me how he did it. He said that Cheryl's dad gave her to me on her birthday. I was supposed to take her shopping for a present. And if you resist my advances, you end up dead in a creek like Cheryl. And it scared the shit out of his victims, who, right, then complied with what he wanted them to do. And it wasn't until he was in jail that they told that story. Now, to the police credit, they went straight to him and they gave him a polygraph. And he denied knowing. He said he knew who Cheryl's dad was. He never met the kids. He didn't even know their names. And he denied ever being around her, talking to her, having her in his presence. And he passed the polygraph. And that's where it ended. John, guy, this is a newer development. since the blog came out. He was not on the police radar in 1971. His name is in the police file in 77 when his victim came forward and said he said that he killed Cheryl. But the things that are kind of like holding holding the cops back with him, or whatever you want to say it is. One, even though I don't put any real stock in polygraphs, he passed the polygraph. He admitted to his other crimes against the other children. He denied Cheryl, and he passed the polygraph. Now, of course, why would he admit to murdering somebody? So, of course, he denied it, and maybe he's a psychopath, and he passed the polygraph. So, that's fine. But then the detective has pointed out, and I would say in fairness, the details that his victims provided pretty much can be found in the newspapers. So he's like, I stabbed her to death. I left her in a creek. It was her birthday. Well, all of that was in the paper at the time. So, and I absolutely 1,000% believe the victims are telling the truth. But what John told them, he could have been lying about committing the crime to get them to comply with his molestation, which is totally disgusting. But now, Bridget is like, I'm sorry. Nobody walks around saying they stabbed a kid and left him in a creek if they didn't do it. And she's like, he's disgusting. He's gross. Like, and she could see, like, she can tie this in with maybe Cheryl's dad. Like, they were kind of in this car theft ring together. They ran around together, that maybe there was some kind of debt that was owed. We've heard rumblings of that, and it's disgusting. But Billy Joe, like, gave Cheryl to him, maybe to spend the day or to do whatever, but maybe not to be killed. But something went wrong where she said, I'm going to tell on you, or blah, 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 and John kills her. And Billy Joe's not going to come forward and be like, well, yeah, I let my daughter... Like, so he's a part of it, so he just goes quiet.
Right.
People that were in that car theft ring that was local there, they, some of them were stealing cars and selling the parts and stuff to fuel their drug habit. So I don't know what the kickbacks were for Billy Joe, if he was a part of it, which I think he was. It might have just been for financial gain. You know, like, they didn't have a lot of money, so maybe he was helping sell the car parts to make some cash. But I've heard that they were both pretty much, like, alcoholics. Could they have been into using, like, drugs, too? I wouldn't be shocked. But nobody has come forward and been like, they were drug users. So I don't know for sure.
If you'll remember, in our previous episode, we talked about the man on the porch. He was known for watching children, following buses, and he even had brown stains on his shirt around the time of Cheryl's murder.
Okay. He was, I feel like he was like 33 or 34, which is, that's like a, I hate to say a good age, but, you know, that puts him in the ballpark of these kind of offenders. No, he wasn't involved in the community. He was like the town weirdo that, like, watched the kids, made inappropriate comments, drove by the school buses, made people feel uncomfortable. I mean, the stories go on for days that people have come out of the woodwork. Once I started talking about him, like, oh my God, like, the one lady lived next door and would find him in her house. You know, like, what? Like, how is this real? Like, I mean, just whatever. But he was not on the police radar until Cheryl's body was found. And then people came forward and said he had been down there in Pendleton County where his family was and was talking about it a lot. Like, it made people uncomfortable. Like, he was real into it. Like, did you hear they found a girl in the creek? And blah, blah, blah. Like, it just made everybody really, really uncomfortable that he was so interested in it and was talking about it so much. And the fact that he lived across the street from the bus stop, like, literally, if he sat on his front porch, he's staring at the kids waiting for the bus. Like, he is the man on, like, I can't explain it to you any easier than it's like a 4-lane highway. If I have a rock and I throw it as hard as I can, it's going to end up in his front yard. It puts him where she possibly was last seen, and it puts him, like, where she was found. And all of his behavior is so... along those lines of just being inappropriate and whatnot. But the two things that hold us back with him is we cannot find anybody at any time where he that will say that he ever talked to any of the kids on the street. He never interacted with them. He didn't, he like watched or whatever, but he, you know, I'm thinking, how would he have groomed Cheryl? And even if she was out kind of by herself in the mornings, like, and supposedly he parked his car, like, nobody ever spotted them chatting or, you know, that takes time sometimes when you're grooming somebody. Like, but again, maybe not. Maybe he was in his car and he saw her up there and he grabbed her and off they went. But that's one. But then two, he has a time card and it is stamped. Like, he went to work at 10 o'clock the night before Cheryl's birthday and he worked until like 10:30 in the morning of her birthday. And it's the times are punched. The supervisor signed off on it. And they, the detective even told me that they went and interviewed the people at his company and they said, like, they will not, they compared the signatures. It's definitely the foreman's signature. They said they will not lie for you. Like, if you're not where you're supposed to be clocking out, like, did that time card, was all this an airtight alibi for him? People all the way around, people were like, he's the guy. But then he just wasn't. Like, and it, I mean, again, I don't know that he wasn't. Like, what if, but I can't get past the time card. So even if some, and here you go again, let's say somebody lied and he did go in the night before and he snuck away and he's going over to the street. How does he know she's going to be up there by herself to grab her? Because she's always there with the group waiting for the bus. Most of the police now that I've talked to said he was scared of his own shadow. Like, he liked scaring people and making them uncomfortable, but he was not ballsy enough to then approach somebody and, like, go up to a little girl and do this. But, I mean, so much of his behavior looked like it was escalating. However, if he killed her in 71, he did weird things continuously through the 70s and 80s and never did it again, as far as we know. But there are no outstanding child murders up here besides Cheryl. So it's like, okay, if he did do it again, I don't know who it would have been in the area. And he didn't really leave this area. So all of these people, it's the morning of her birthday. She happens to run late. She happens to be spotted by a child murderer and she gets killed. It could happen, but it just doesn't feel like that's how it would have unfolded for me after all this time.
Could Billy Joe have anything to do with Cheryl's murder?
Right. And believe me, we researched the hell out of her family tree and she does not have an uncle. So whoever her dad was an only child. And then his mom had a girl like years later who was married, but apparently they didn't see them ever. So she wouldn't have known that man enough to be like, my uncle's taking me somewhere. And then the stepmom had younger brothers, but Cheryl's brothers have said, like, they were, like, teenagers. We called them by their first names. None of them were uncles. Now, might she have said that because that's easier to explain, like, to somebody that you don't know well, like my uncle. But, like, it wasn't, they were not, I don't know. Again, I don't know.
Right.
And I don't even know that, I mean, I believe the woman that told that story, but it's, like, I just feel like 50 years does things to people's heads. Like,
that's true.
You know, like, you can absolutely believe that she told you that, and then if you had time traveled and went back, like, she said that 3 weeks prior or something. She said, I'm going, I don't know.
Right.
So I guess something definitely could have been promised to her. This John guy, so if, you know, you're asking about Bridget, like, could he have been called an uncle because he was a family acquaintance, even though he swears he didn't know the family? And the brothers have said that John was never around. So mm-hmm. That's weird because it's like, well, I just pictured John was like hanging out at the house and that's how he kind of got to meet Cheryl enough that he'd take her somewhere for her birthday. But the brothers are like, no, like nobody ever came into her house. Like my dad didn't really have friends that he hung out with. So then I'm like, okay, well, how does this John guy even encounter Cheryl? I don't know, besides maybe the dad letting her spend time with him, but the brothers never knew that. And they, I mean, I will say some things they said to me set off little alarm bells about their dad in my head. And it's just because in my reality, that doesn't make sense. But in their reality, it's normal. And I sometimes have to remember that, like, just because I think it's in poor taste not to buy your child a headstone, if you're poor and that's not important to you, like, I can't even really say that without making it almost sound laughable. But, like, the lady at the cemetery said, there are a lot of people buried here without headstones. Like, some people do not find comfort here, and they move away, and they just kind of let it go. Like, don't read into it too much. Where I was like, oh, my God, like, how, you know, how could you, I would make a monument, I'd make a shrine to my child. You're like, but that's what I would do. But it doesn't mean that's what everybody would do. And, ugh, it's hard. Anyway, so some of the things the brother said, like, my dad only ever shared one emotion, and that was anger. And I'm like, oh, you know, like, that made me go, like, angry enough to harm your child. But, you know, he didn't show grief, and he didn't show concern, and he didn't, but he showed anger. So that didn't sit right with me. But it doesn't mean that he killed his own daughter. So it's just all in the context. But the brothers also don't feel strongly about anybody. Like, the way, you know, we talked about the man on the porch, and they're like, yeah, he never was down our street. We never saw our sister talking to him. Like, I don't know how he would have found her. So then, you know, everybody I said, they were just like, yeah, no, I'm not feeling it. Like, but at the same time, they don't feel strongly. To them, it's still truly a mystery, too, that of the one morning that she oversleeps and is running behind and leaves by herself, she gets killed. It was great meeting them, and I've had time to kind of decompress and think about it, and I do think some of their being is self-preservation, and maybe they just won't let their minds go there enough to really see it, you know. It could have been the milkman, or it could have been the man on the porch. They just, it's like, no, that person couldn't have done it. Because you don't want, it's so hard to say, oh, my God, it could have been that person. Like, it's like opening that door again. So their perspective was great, and it was great talking to them. But I also know, like, they've been victimized. So the way they come at things is different than somebody like me. That's just, I'm just writing a blog about this, and I have all these questions. I haven't lived with it. They are private in general because of the loss. And, you know, they did say that every so many years around the anniversary of her death, the news starts calling. And, like, there's nothing else that they feel like they can give. Like, yep, somebody killed my sister and it's still unsolved. Thanks for reminding me. Like, and this year will be the 50th anniversary. And they're like, the news stations will be trying to find us to get a statement. And I feel like they're just exhausted. And the fact that they even met with us meant a lot to me, because I felt like they're, I don't want to say, when I say they're over it, they're not over it, but they're just so over, like, reliving it and speculating about it and everything else. They said, you know how many police detectives have passed through her case? Like, in 93, we were talking to this guy, and he was, like, all hot to trot that he had a lead, and, like, then we never heard from him again. You know, like, they've just been let down so many times that it's like, you know, this latest police detective that I'm working with, I like him. They're like, we don't really want to talk to him because, it, like, if he can tell us that he's got DNA and he's going to prove it, then that's great, let's go. But, like, what is he going to ask me the same questions that every detective has ever asked me? Like, ugh, they're just exhausted from it. And I get that, like, and here's me and Bridget, like, okay, so tell us about that day. And what it, like, like, they were like, oh, God, here we go again. So I think that's why I think that's why they're private. I think that they were raised, how do I say this? I feel almost in an unhealthy way, their dad kept them very insulated. They did not have relationships with grandparents. They didn't have relationships with, like, aunts and uncles. They moved all the time. So it was like they didn't form good, like, bonds with teachers or, you know, classmates or whatever. And I think that could be viewed as suspicious a little bit when you're trying not to let your kids have those healthy relationships with other people. But because of that, like, I just think that they are not open. They're just very, very private because that's how they were raised. Like, you don't let anybody in. It's just us. That makes sense.
Right.
Which is why they didn't know their extended family in Pendleton County where she was found and where Billie Joe's dad lived. And they didn't know their aunts and uncles and cousins up in Cincinnati on their mom's side. And they said when their mom didn't come home for Cheryl's funeral, they never spoke to her again. They completely cut her out of their life. And I said, well, why do you think she never came back? He's like, I don't know. I was 13. She didn't show up. I was done with her forever. Done. So, like, maybe, and who am I to say? I've never lost a sibling, and I've never had a parent just bow out of my life. So, like,
right.
I just remember, it's just so, like, horrible that I feel that they've had so much tragedy.
While Beth and Bridget interviews citizens, police, and family, rumors spread that someone is looking into Cheryl's case. Beth describes how Highland Heights residents have reacted to their investigation.
I think, all in all, I have been blessed that people are pretty talkative because it's just such an outrage that a 10-year-old would be killed on her birthday or disappear on her birthday and murdered. And, like, a lot of people didn't know about it. So I would say, like, our generation, you guys are probably younger than me, but now that this is sort of a thing, people are really like, what do you mean there's an unsolved? They're just completely taken by the story because we all grew up around here and didn't even know. But then the older generation, which are the people that, I swear I'm not calling them old, but the people that would have been Cheryl's age that were born in, like, 61 when she was born, feel so, have felt so, like, abandoned by it. Like, the kids that grew up around here, and then she was killed, and then we never heard anything else about it. Like, finally, people are rallying together to say this isn't right. So I've had a positive response. People are willing to talk about it, to share the story, to cry out for justice. I would say that in general, I do feel, I don't want to say bad, but, like, it does put a black cloud over your city a little bit that you've got this outstanding child homicide and it was never solved. So, you know, because my husband's in law enforcement, I know that cops don't like that, you know, like, it's a bad look. So I think I will give absolute credit to the state police detective who, I don't know if eagerly is the right word, but when I said, like, can I please meet with you? I want to share with you everything I know. And he, like, said, yeah, let's do it. He at least was willing to work with a citizen detective, so to speak, where so many of these stories you hear, the cops just don't want to do it. Like, I don't know if it's an ego or if they're just scared of opening that door, but,
right.
You know, he was great about it. So I think all in all, people are pretty open to it and have been pretty good about sharing it up here, not just in Highland Heights, but in the city surrounding it. To give myself credit, I have been very strategic, and I don't think I set out that way in the beginning, but I've learned that it's important. Like, the first thing I did not do was call the cops because they'd be like, who are you and what are you doing? So, like, I knew I needed to do a lot of the legwork myself, get some people behind me, and then talk to other cops. And I did have an in, and, like, some of them knew my husband and my father-in-law. So it's, like, yeah, you know, like, they knew whose wife I was. And, like, would you be, I'm looking at this case. Sure. So, like, I wasn't just a rando. It was, like, I had a connection. So then I kind of got somewhere with it, and the blog was taking off, and they're like, holy cow, she really is talking to people. She knows her shit. Then they were more willing to meet with me. But I know that if I had just called the state police in the very beginning, I don't know. And, well, the other thing, too, is I started, because I did the blog, then I started meeting extended family members of Cheryl's. So then I got them in my corner. So when they called the state police with the last name Spiegel and said, I want you to look at my cousin's unsolved murder, and I want you to talk to this person, Beth, who's been researching the case, then they did it. But I didn't have those people behind me in the beginning. Does that make sense? So it's like all of it took time. I had to get the momentum going and make the right connection. I think the sad thing is that people do like it to be wrapped up. You watch Dateline, and at the end, the murderer goes to jail. You know, you watch, like, that's what we all want, because we do. That's why we do this. We want justice for the person or whatever. And I keep thinking, how am I going to end this if we can't solve it? Because I'm a realist, and I am not quitting. I still think there's work to do. But if we do turn over every stone and we can't get there, because we need DNA and I don't have DNA, and that's the bottom line. So, like, if that's where this is going to end, how do I end this story without it being solved? And the legacy could be, like, how do we make her death not in vain? Or how do we make Cheryl's story not just about her murder? It's about more than that. And I'm going to plug a book. I just read a book called What Happened to Paula by Catherine Dykstra. And there's this unsolved murder of this girl named Paula from the 1970s. And it's not what happened to Paula with a question mark, because she's a missing person that they presume is murdered. But it's the whole story of what happened to Paula, like how her life set her up to be victimized, how she was killed, and then the fallout afterwards, so that what happened to Paula shouldn't happen to other people. It was such a good book. So then part of me is like, that is what I need to do with Cheryl too. It's not just what happened to her that day and how she was murdered. It's how does a girl like that get in that situation, and how do we as society just move on with life? They will take calls. So if anybody has information, they can call the state police. I mean, they dusted it off when I came calling, but they will, at least in the state of Kentucky, and I know sometimes I'm not well-versed in the entire, if it's a, you know, every state's the same or whatever, but in Kentucky, they will not close an unsolved homicide, which is great. But the thing that's irritating is they won't give me the police file or the family or whatever, because it's an open investigation. But my point is, like, so is it going to be open for 3,000 years? Like, I mean, is it until everybody on the planet who was living in 1971 is dead? Like, that's frustrating. But I'm okay with that. If, and I do think they are, by us calling, they dusted it off. Let's get some new eyes on it. Are there names in this file that need to be revisited? And by me and you and people that put these cases out there, all it takes is the right person to hear it and say, I have an ex-boyfriend who told me he did it, or I have a neighbor that I always suspected, now I'm going to talk. Because I don't think that we're necessarily, probably the killer of Cheryl is dead, but I think there's somebody living on this planet who knows what happened. And that's just what we want. We just want to know what happened, maybe why it happened, and great if we could prosecute. But in talking with the prosecutors down here in Campbell County, who I do respect, they said, you know, even if Joe Smith walks in off the street and says, I did it, I killed her in a fit of rage, blah, 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 they're still going to want to have to prove that. Because many guys on death row confess to murders, but then they can't prove it.
Exactly.
So I'm even want to say to the killer, like, you might not even get charged at this point, because if there's you, congratulations, you committed the perfect crime. There's no DNA. There's no murder weapon. There's no clothes. Good for you. But at least just be a man and tell us what happened that day. Like, so we can just move on from this. Now, the brothers might not agree with me. They said they want justice, and they have every right to say that. And I hope that they get it. Whereas I'm just like, I want to let that poor milkman rest in peace if it's not him. And I want the man on the porch to get his name back and say, he's a weirdo, but he didn't kill anybody. You know, like, leave him alone. He's the Boo Radley of the neighborhood. I want to be able to just leave her poor father alone, let him rest in peace. He had nothing to do with it, or whatever it is. Like, we can move on. But I'm getting messages still from people that have little bits of information. So it's like, I know, by putting it out there just in time, the right heat is applied to the right person, or the right person hears it and finally is grown a conscience or whatever. All it takes is one person to call me or the state police, and it could crack it open. And that is what we want. So that's, I mean, in the meantime, it's just the weirdest thing. And like you in doing what you do, you know, because you think about cases, it's like I live with this girl in my head and she shows up in my dreams and she shows up in my daughter's dreams. And I have Cardinal memorabilia around the house and notes from the host of the Unsolved Mysteries podcast that is commending me on my work of Cheryl's case. Like what is happening? You know, like it's a beautiful thing, but it's like, it's become a part of not just my life, but my family's life and people I'm friends with now. Like I made friends with like prosecutors and police people. They're my friends because of Cheryl. People I would have never met. It's just a weird space to be in. And I mean, I like enjoy doing it for her, but it's weird. Yeah. So she would have been like an older cousin or something. Right. Like, so I think, do I sometimes think of her as a 60-year-old who's getting ready to have her 60th birthday, or is she just always a 10-year-old? And for me, I see her more as a child. I think it's because I'm a teacher and I'm a mom, and that's just where she's frozen in time. And I have these weird philosophies sometimes about the afterlife, but it's like, okay, if the afterlife is like what we typically think of it as, like, and she's there, like, I see her as a little girl. But I don't know, like, I don't, you know, my friend Erin that feels like she kind of can sense Cheryl at yoga and all this stuff that, like, definitely Bridget's more of an empath than I am. I'm just not, it's just not who I am. But they're like, she's everywhere that you are. When you talk about her, like, she knows. And, like, Erin's like, Cheryl's just telling you to relax. Because I'm always like, I don't know, yeah. I'm like, I know. But then I'm like, and then I feel bad for her that she's on the other side telling me to calm down. She needs to go, like, play with the angels or whatever. Like, that's, like, it's just so weird. But I know I'm going to hang up this phone with you in a little bit, and I'm going to go outside, and I'm going to see a cardinal. And I'm going to know, like, that's a sign that, like, hey, thanks for what you did. You know, like, it's a really beautiful experience. It's just so not something I ever expected to happen. And I feel blessed to be a part of it and to be able to be her voice. It's very rewarding. I just wish that we could have the answer. That's my hope. And that's why I like to spread her story. But also, like, just to encourage other people, too. These people, the victims, deserve to have their stories told. And not just about their murder, but about their lives.
Beth goes on to tell us that Cheryl is more than her murder, but somehow most of her character and personality have been lost to time.
Because she, like, Cheryl was somebody's daughter. She was somebody's sister. I talked to some of her extended family. Like, she was somebody's niece. She was a flower girl in a wedding. She was a friend with some little girls on the street who were grown women who've never been able to maintain a relationship, who have never had children of their own, who are scarred from this. And those people deserve to have, to acknowledge her murder did something to you too, and it's not right. So it's like I said, that book, What Happened to Paula, What Happened to Cheryl, I mean, this is really sad to say, but she suffered a horror the day she was killed, and it was probably over in 10 minutes, you know? And these people have carried this shit with them for 50 years, and they're still living in hell because of what somebody did in a fit of anger or for some, you know, whatever the reason is, it's not worth what the hell that everybody else has gone through. The ripple effect, the collateral damage, and her brothers, if they're not involved, and I tend to think they're not, but like they are messed up for life, and wouldn't you be, or wouldn't I be, or, you know, I can't even imagine being in their position. And then, you know, I really try to respect them because it's like, then you have people like us coming through and trying to analyze it and figure it out, and they appreciate it, but it's also like, that's their little sister. So, I mean, there's a couple things that I want to do. I've thought about, you know, we got Cheryl a headstone and it was easy. People were so generous with their money. There are other people that can't afford headstones. Like, do we set up something that, like, in Cheryl's name, that's what we do. We get people headstones. Is that dumb? Or do we fight for legislation that after so many years of a cold case, the police need to hand over what they have to the family? I don't know yet. And I feel like the answer will come, that maybe we can do something in Cheryl's name beyond this for her sake. So we'll see. Again, we're still working on it, but it never ends.
At this point, we're searching for the truth, not an arrest.
I mean, I honestly, I just feel like sharing it because, granted, like somebody sitting in their car listening to this story in Washington State is probably not going to know who killed Cheryl, but they can join what I call like the army of people saying it's not right what was done to her, and it's not necessarily the police's fault, and it's not necessarily anybody's fault. Like I've told the detective that's working the case now, you are not responsible for the investigation that was conducted in 1971. You weren't even born yet, and nor was I. So we have to take with what we have, and now we have to do what's right, you know, like what the best that we can do. And I think just having support and an outcry, and we're not saying that to put anybody's head on a stake, but to say this cannot happen again. This should not happen again. Like, if this happened now, we would want it handled differently so that it's not in vain. But me just starting the TikTok thing, which honestly is because I'm looking at my audience and people are my age and older, and it's like there's a younger generation who, by the way, could be the daughter of the killer or the granddaughter of the killer that always heard the story. So, like, how do you reach the youth? They're not on Facebook anymore, right? Because I teach middle school. I know they're on TikTok. So how do I take the story, make it interesting, make it appealing to people, be authentic to Cheryl without sensationalizing it? You know, so I had to get creative with my writing and get myself a little narrator because people don't want to hear a 43-year-old trying to voice a 10-year-old, you know, like, so tapped my daughter to do that. So, like, we're putting her story out there because it could get in the right hands. So that's why it's like if you share the story, share the podcast. I'm still getting messages from people that have clues, and I think it's because they saw, you know, it's just out there more. You know, somebody listening lived in Kentucky in 1971 and knew the Spiegel family, like, call me up or call the state police because you never know. Like, when I asked her brothers, like, tell me a little bit about Cheryl, they were very quiet. And I was taken aback because it's like, well, I have little brothers. I could go on and on about my little brothers. But I think some of it is so, like, private or they're so scarred from it. It's like, it's hard to remember because it hurts. So, like, I sometimes, like, long for little tidbits of stories about her so that I can share more with people who she was as a person. Because everybody's like, oh, she was real sweet and cute, which is wonderful. But that's how I would describe almost any 10-year-old girl that I ever encountered. So it's like, was she spunky? Was she funny? Was she shy? Like, I wish I could know more about her. She was somebody's daughter. She had three brothers. She had grandparents who did care about her and love her, even though she didn't see them very often. You know, she had classmates at school that had to sit there and look at an empty desk and wonder why she was killed. And, like, she mattered to a lot of people, even if she didn't know that she mattered at the time. And the crazy thing is that she died almost 50 years ago, and she still is making an impression and mattering to people who are living on the planet. And that, to me, like, legacy, that you can, they say you die twice. Like, the first time is when your body dies, and the second time is when no one speaks your name ever again. And, like, she has not died twice, because we're still speaking her name and sharing her story. I don't want to misspeak, but I think it's, like, even if we say we think it's so-and-so, and that person has died, in order to close the case, they would still say, based on this evidence, it was so-and-so and that person has died. And it would probably have to be DNA anymore. Like, they don't close the case because somebody comes forward and says, because he confessed to me 20 years ago. So some of those cold cases, I love seeing those old cases that are 30 years old, 40 years old. You know, and sometimes the perpetrator is still alive and they're going to be charged. And sometimes they have the DNA from the swab or whatever, and that person has since died. but then they'll close the case because it's confirmed through DNA. He's the one that killed her. He died 10 years ago. Case closed. But it gives resolution to the family. You know, obviously the killer's not going to be prosecuted, but we know who did it, and now we can close the case. I would love for that to happen. I just don't know how we will without DNA. And, you know, maybe somebody has her clothes somewhere, and I doubt it. But, like, that maybe there's DNA on clothes. In some of those old cases, it's because they have the clothes from the crime scene. And yeah. Cheryl was found unclothed, so we don't have that. Frustrating. You know, they said she had on a blouse, a skirt, shoes and socks, and a little purse. And it's like, well, you know, maybe a shoe was dropped somewhere or came off in the guy's car that she was in or whatever. But that could be true, but where is the shoe now? So, like, did he keep it or did it just get disregarded? But, like, a psychic could see that that happened. But that doesn't help us now, you know. And I think the psychic avenue is fascinating and it was helpful and it was like tingle, like your spidey sense, like, oh, this is so weird. I mean, it was the weirdest experience and like neat, but like, I'm just, I don't want to sound like a bitch, but like, just tell me who the name of the killer is. I'm so like, I think that you're awesome at what you're doing, but like, I'm not any closer to the answer after having, I don't know, maybe I am. I think sometimes you might get a clue and be like, holy cow, it's what the psychic said. But without the clue, it doesn't get me there. One of the cops told me, I put this on the one TikTok video too, like even stone cold killers have nightmares. Like even the worst of the worst can be haunted by it and the need to like, they either cry out in their sleep or they're so haunted by it, they have to like tell somebody because it is eating them alive. And you tell somebody who someday may become disloyal to you, right? Girlfriends, best friends, and you have a falling out or somebody, you know, that you used to do drugs with, who's now cleaned up their life. Like, I think if I do think the killer probably told somebody, and that's where I'm thinking the killer may be dead, but not the person that heard it or not the person who heard its kid. And I know it's hearsay, but it's still something. Because that's not a lie. Like, somebody knows. But the person might be dead, but, like, somebody. Because somebody, even if somebody could be the person who killed her, but somebody knows. And somebody's talked. I truly, the more I do it, I believe it. I just don't think one person did this by themselves and never spoke of it again. I just have a hard time. Either in the dead of night or in the early morning or whatever, take some balls. And you carry a dead girl down the side of an embankment and take the time to bury her. Like, maybe you had somebody driving your car who was looking out. Maybe you had somebody who was helping you move the rocks. I don't know. Maybe you did it all by yourself. And I still, all of it is still fascinating. And I don't mean that to be, like, disrespectful. But if you killed a girl in a fit of rage, you have her in your car, you drive 23 miles out to the middle of nowhere and take all this time to bury her under rocks, why don't you just throw her out the side of the car down by the river? Or we have so many places out here that you could just toss somebody. So I think it's because the person knew that place and they cared about her. And I know that that's weird to say, but like, to take the time to bury her, they didn't just throw her over the side of the embankment. And again, I think one of the last blog entries, whenever that time comes, is going to be called like 6:25 or 6:30. Because whatever happened, I think that date at that time is the, like, if I could time travel, I would go October 19th, 1971 at 6:20 in the morning to their street and either see her get abducted, see her dad put her in a car, see her get killed in the house, like, see her get taken out of the house somewhere. Whatever happened, it's that crucial time right there. My mom worries about, like, my mom will say, like, when are you done? Like, when are we going to not have conversations about Cheryl? And, like, the sad thing is I don't have the answer. Like, I don't, is this going to be another year of my life? Or is this going to be 5 more years of my life? Or, like, I don't know. It's bizarre. It's like she's a part of everybody's you know, I went to my nephew's birthday party and my sister-in-law's parents were there and they're like, so what's the latest? It's like, they don't ask about my children. They want to know about Cheryl. It's just so weird. But it's okay. Like, I love it. She's like a child of my heart. You know, she's raised, like, I'll talk about her just like I talk about the three kids I'm raising. It's just strange. Okay, so the blog site is www.goneinthefog.video.blog. But if you just, like, Google search Gone in the Fog, it brings up the blog. And then I have a Facebook group with everybody that's kind of followed along because of the blog or because they've heard a story on a podcast or whatever, and that is called Gone in the Fog. And then I have an Instagram account, same thing, but Instagram's kind of hard because, you know, you just post a picture or whatever. Like, it doesn't really give a lot of information. And then we recently just started putting a story out there on TikTok. And that is called Gone in the Fog. So, like, at least in terms of remembering what things are called, it's all the same. But the whole story is housed on the blog, or I record it in an audio form on SoundCloud. And some people prefer to just listen instead of reading. And you can listen to all of the entries on SoundCloud if you search Gone in the Fog. I'm just trying to, from the beginning, I wanted to do her right, you know, do right by her story so that, and I've tried very hard to not be biased, because if I had been, I would have been selling people on certain suspects at all different times. It's like, at the end of the day, I can say, could be this person, might not be the, you know, because I just want it to be true. So, or we just will never know.
The best thing we can do as internet detectives, armchair detectives, whatever you want to call us, is to share Cheryl's case so that her death and her murder is not in vain. Amber and I were so lucky to interview Beth, and honestly, I never thought that Amber and I would be in a place to where we had the opportunity to interview someone with so much knowledge and so much passion about a case. We're so grateful and thankful for Beth and Bridget and everyone else that helps them just research Cheryl's case and continue on fighting for the truth. That's the most important part, is finding the truth. You can find links to Beth's blog, TikTok, Facebook, and Twitter down below. You can always find Amber and I at Crime Cafe Pod on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. If you have any information about the murder of Cheryl Spiegel, please call the Kentucky State Police at 502-782-1781.